Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
It's the last version of the Retail Focus Podcast for March. Trent Kling joined by Leighton Kling. We'll talk a little Amazon as their Amazon Go concept gets put temporarily on hold. We'll also discuss GameStop and some disappointing earnings, Restoration Hardware showing a beat, and one hardware store to close out the show. In fact, a hardware co-op we have not discussed yet on the Retail Focus Podcast. But first, we begin with Ollie's Bargain Outlet, one of our top five retailers to watch for the year 2017. And boy, was this last quarter their best ever, just about when it came to beating analyst expectations. They exceeded expectation in nearly every financial category during their latest earnings release. Their CEO, Mark Butler, said, and I quote, "Candidly, fiscal 2016 was Ollie's greatest year ever. The company exceeded their long-term initiatives with this latest quarter turned in, as well as their full fiscal year." His results came in this Tuesday afternoon. Net income increased 52% to $24.4 million, and earnings per diluted share came in at 39 cents, with estimates at 35 cents per share. This represents a 4 cents per share beat, but those weren't the only two numbers that Ollie's found excellence in.
No, absolutely not. And to be honest, if we're going to be candid here, Trent, this is a concept that you and I absolutely love. And to remind our listeners, this was actually one of our looking ahead stories for 2017 as a whole. This company is very unique, and it's unique in a multitude of ways. Here we see that the company is extremely profitable right now, and they saw top line revenue also increase for this latest quarter by about 16%. Analysts were actually projecting about 15%, which if you look at the retail landscape, that alone would be a good number, but they hit $283 million versus the expectations of about $280 million. Same store sales, a figure we look at often, 2% for the company overall. But if you look at a two-year stack, they've increased 14%. So if you look back, last year's comps were hard to go up against, but they still met and exceeded their own company expectations. Same store sales for the full fiscal year reached a very stout 3.2%. Gross profit also increased for the company 14.7% to $113.4 million. However, decreased gross margin by 60 basis points to about 40% overall. So you're saying that the gross margin amount is actually higher in totality than the margin itself. However, they did cite higher merchandise costs, but lower transportation costs and distribution costs that factored in to the price of goods. With Ollie's, Trent, you have a company that just IPO'd 2 years ago in July of 2015. So it's relatively new overall in terms of a stock, but it's been around for quite some time. And you see with CEO Mark Butler, he's been bullish on this concept for quite some time. And if you want a reminder of this concept, Ollie's is more than just a so-called off-price retailer that a lot of the media outlets covering the story were calling it. They have a very transparent strategy to buy closeout, salvage, and surplus merchandise in order to do two things. Namely, one, offer merchandise that is similar but cheaper than their big box competitors, and then two, have an ever-changing product selection to keep customers coming in to shop as though they're on a treasure hunt. This is highlighted through obvious social media outlets all the time with them. They say that every experience inside an Ollie's needs to be like a treasure hunt experience, and so they want people coming in not expecting the same thing over and over again, but finding one-time buys that are extremely special, and they do try to buy with seasonality in mind. So you might go in during the summertime and see some very expensive sunscreen lotion that may be $13 normally at a Walmart, but it may be just $2.50 there. They also have variable and fixed costs relatively low because they try to focus on the general store presentation a little less than other merchandisers. This is more of an Aldi in that regard, in that Aldi just cares about getting the product onto the floor and making sure that they have fresh items out there, but they don't really focus on the continued expectation of a clean storefront and those types of things. they don't focus on end cap maintenance and other qualities within inside their store. And then also, lastly, Trent, with the regard to how they're differentiated within the market, their retail presence really doesn't have to be top notch. So that gives them an edge because they don't have to be in a high income area as other retailers or even a low income area. So as they see a store open up, and they cited this in their earnings call, if they see a potential and advantageous position opening up in a particular market, they are going to take advantage of it. So they're not going to be hamstrung by following a rigid guideline of where to open new locations.
And as far as that's concerned, that's a unique approach, even to off-price retailing. When you look at stores like TJ Maxx and Ross, or any of the TJX companies, really some of the off-price darlings of late, you see that they still do have pretty rigid requirements as far as traffic of certain locations, whereas Ollie's, not only are they off-price in terms of product, but they're off-price in terms of real estate as well. And one thing they've mentioned in previous releases and in previous presentations is they've been able to actually reap benefits from the massive amount of closures in many brick-and-mortar stores, especially if those closures are in freestanding locations. Several Ollie's stores, for example, have opened up in old Kmart locations or old grocery store locations where grocers have perhaps felt pressure from national competition from the likes of Walmart, Kroger, and other large retailers. So that's something that Mark Butler certainly mentioned during this earnings release as well, as the fact that they're in an advantageous position with real estate and enables them to pay off new store openings very quickly when they do purchase the real estate. And as a result, they actually get better than expected results from new locations, not only in terms of the bottom line, but also in terms of their top line revenue. One thing they mentioned in their annual Investor Day presentation is the fact that they've seen, based on their data, that customer loyalty is top notch with Ollie's Bargain Outlet, and customers will drive 30 to 40 miles just to get to an Ollie's. So with that type of customer engagement, when they do open up a new store, it carries with it a certain amount of fanfare, thus boosting the overall performance of the store, despite the fact that it may not be in a popular retail area of town or may not be in a high traffic area of town. He also credited strong deal flow with incoming merchandise and tight budgeting for two reasons as to why they had their recent quarterly success that they've been able to achieve. And I wanted to focus on the deal flow. Something they said during their last quarter earnings call was once again echoed during their fourth quarter earnings call, which was to keep building vendor relationships and keep that deal flow coming in with incoming merchandise. And the company has mentioned ever since their IPO a couple of years ago, they've gotten more notoriety. They're being covered more in the news cycles. They're being covered more, honestly, by shows like this, Layton. And what that's done is that's created these connections with vendors and also people that may have what they call kind of derailed commodity so that they can build those relationships with those vendors. They have 22 different product categories, most of which during the last quarter saw positive increases. The best performing areas were electronic accessories, which in terms of off price, but also in terms of dollar stores, we've seen massive leaps and bounds in that particular category. They also saw growth in the HBA portion of their business, or the health and beauty portion, as well as clothing, which is unique. Oftentimes we talk about many clothing retailers that are full price struggling, off-price clothing retailers seeing the exact opposite happen to them. They've also seen good performances in toys and food and candy. And many of these categories, with perhaps the exception of food and candy, see high margins, particularly health and beauty products and toys. It's also something they said during their last earnings call, which was their third quarter earnings call a little over 3 months ago, was echoed once again on Tuesday of this week, which is building those vendor relationships. And we talked about how their IPO enabled them to connect with some additional vendors, but also their larger store footprint. As they continue to grow, their larger store footprint enables them to make connections with perhaps vendors throughout the country that they wouldn't otherwise have connected with. And I found this interesting, Layton. Since their IPO 2 years ago, Ollie's has closed just one store. During that period of time, they have opened over 60 locations. So massive expansion since they turned public. They've been able to increase their overall store count since their IPO by about 35%. And this has given them, in turn, access to more vendors and also the ability to buy in bulk more often because they can spread merchandise throughout their stores. However, we should note that they need to be careful going forward not to alienate vendors where they might have bought 100% of a salvage fleet in the past. They might be a little bit more picky in the future. Vendors might come to expect them to buy the same amount of damaged goods, not just, you know, say 65 or 70% of a batch, which is something that they noted is they're going to try and be more careful in terms of product selection. But one of the things really that set all of these apart is the fact that they basically turned down nothing. And because of this, it's created a unique shopping experience, one in which they're able to drive customer engagement. And I think you really see that through their Ollie's Army program.
Yeah, they're very bullish on this concept. It's a free membership rewards program tied to dollars spent. So to give you a little bit of a down-to-earth example, for every $250 you spend as part of this loyalty program, you get a 10% off one purchase thereafter. They also send out emails giving special discounts and then upcoming events as well, where they might have some of those seasonal pieces of merchandise coming in through their doors. And then also, one time a year, they offer a special Ollie's Army membership event. This gives customers a one-time discount one time a year to come in and really try to take advantage of all of the goods they have in their individual stores. The company said that membership rates are up, Trent, which we all know this is a very good thing. It doesn't take long before you look at the retail industry and see that there is a correlation between those retailers that have memberships and growing sales between those that don't. Ulta Beauty comes to mind. They've had a very high success rate with people coming in through the doors, higher traffic numbers, higher per transaction amounts. And so I think this is something that they are trying to take advantage of. When reality, a lot of off-price retailers, a lot of dollar stores that could potentially be competitors with Ollie's Bargain Outlet really aren't taking advantage of these types of things. They said they want to actually continue growing the membership program, and that means that they're going to be looking at the analytics side of the data. So obviously with this membership rewards program, they oftentimes have more than just your email address, Trent. So they're trying to get down to the nitty-gritty, get down to who their core customers are, and down to what those core customers buy most oftentimes. So they want to tie in these historical purchases to upcoming deals as well. They said they actually rolled out their first iteration of some sort of a pilot program that has people that were previously buying pool supplies and lawn fertilizer to be buying other things that are coming up in the summertime, and they hope to convert these to upcoming products within those summer categories. Using data to more understand their core customers and identify trends, I had mentioned that they want to identify who their core customers are, but the trend analysis is extremely important. We talk about the acquisition of 8451 by Kroger. Analytics is where the future is, and I think this would really help them in terms of procurement, which actually fits nicely into what you were saying about really wanting to pick and choose rather than just buy everything in a given circumstance. If you have a really good relationship with an insurance adjuster, it is a little bit interesting that you would just buy everything overall, but this will actually help tailor some of their buying practices towards being a little more budget friendly, a little more careful when you're trying to procure certain items for different types of seasonality effects and the like. Overall, to tie this into the big picture, we see that membership rewards, it's an interesting thing because those that have loyalty programs tend to focus on their core customers, those customers who end up spending more, either it be a credit card reward program or something similar to this. Rewarding these people can often be more lucrative than acquiring new customers, in fact. And so if you watch Shark Tank, for instance, they're always talking about customer acquisition costs, how much it costs for an e-commerce business to acquire each additional customer. And I think here you see that a company sees customers buying a lot of merchandise on an annualized basis, and they want to reward those people. They want those people to keep coming back into those stores because long term, those are going to be the most valuable customers, at least on a rate of return basis.
So let's talk about looking ahead with Ollie's. The company opened, again, two new stores in the fourth quarter. We mentioned now they have only closed one store during the last 24 months. They now have 31 new stores during the entirety of the last fiscal year. And looking ahead, they continue to see expansion during the course of the next year. They didn't really specify exactly how many stores, but they wanted to continue to grow store count in fiscal year 2017. They also cited now having 7 stores in Florida, which is important for the company to note because 2016 was the first year they had a presence there. So again, expanding out slowly but surely from the east, where they are very, very popular. And looking ahead, they'll be targeting expansion in areas where, of course, other retailers are closing stores to take advantage of the real estate deal. Now, the next year or next fiscal year outlook for Ollie's, they want a full year earnings per share number of $1.12 to $1.15 per share, which is above analyst expectations of $1.09 per share. And they cited desires for top line revenue around just above $1 billion, so $1.025 billion to $1.035 billion, which is right around where the consensus is at, just shy of $1.03 billion. They also want same-store sales up 1% to 2%, and I think Leighton, you and I agree that they could easily exceed these numbers if they continue rolling with the same amount of success that they had last year. And given the amount of momentum generally in the off-price segment, it would not be a surprise to see them certainly beat at least earnings per share of analyst expectations, but also that top line revenue number. They also mentioned the desire to pay down debt more in 2017. We talked about how much they've expanded over the past 2 years. With that expansion and with that capital investment, sometimes comes debt, and they want to try and pay that down and ultimately over time return value to the shareholders. After this earnings call, they did surge over 6% on the market during trading on Wednesday. Shares are near an all-time high, or pardon me, at an all-time high after at least this earnings announcement, but right now hovering right around $35 a share. In fact, today just shy of $35 per share. Shares are up 24% over the trailing 3 months, which shows some investors that this could be a powerful long-term investment for a company that continues to grow, but at the same time continues to focus on same-store performance for their existing location.
You would not surprise me to see Ollie's Bargain Outlet at another all-time high in December, but we'll be keeping a close eye on them. Again, they were a concept we were looking forward to covering a little bit more in 2017. We move on with the behemoth that is in Amazon as they started to face severe hurdles with both its online delivery service of groceries and its beta brick and mortar location in Seattle, Washington. First, we must highlight some of the issues facing their convenience store concept in the Seattle area that is so far only open to Amazon employees. We mentioned that this is a beta test, and with doing so, they are really only offering this location, this convenience store, to their 25,000 employees in that area. Their first brick and mortar convenience store opened in January of this year, as we had highlighted on a previous podcast. The 1,800 square foot Go store offers prepared foods. Obviously, we're talking about TV dinners and the like, and then they include fresh breakfast, lunch, dinner, and snacks as well, just like any other grocery store would. And they also have some other staple goods such as baked goods, bread, milk, and cheese. So it's more of an in-and-out concept that may be just slightly larger than your average convenience store. The concept overall is aimed at giving those customers entering the store very little interaction with the employees working there. So they want this to be an in-and-out experience, kind of an on-the-go experience, hence the name Go. On the Retail Focus last year, we had described some of the expensive technology that has gone into each individual store, some that is actually proprietary in nature. During that podcast, Trent, I looked at the little rundown notes that we had created for that. Some of the Sam's Club locations years prior actually tried to have some RFID technology built into some of their locations to enable customers to come in and out of the store, therefore creating sort of a tally on their mobile device. However, that did not come to fruition. The sensors that Amazon are using are actually tracking the merchandise in one's basket or shopping cart, and then they charge the customer upon exiting the store. So it's a very exciting thing. And if you look right now at Amazon's YouTube video depicting the in-store experience there at that location, they now have over 8.6 million views. So even though it is in beta, it seems to have picked up momentum, at least from the outside in.
Longtime listeners of the podcast know that I've been somewhat cynical about this concept overall. We noted during the last time we talked about it that if massive convenience store operators like 7-Eleven and Alimentación Couche-Tard have experimented with this technology and couldn't quite get it quite functional, but they're still working on it. They're in a better position because of their distribution network and their experience with brick and mortar. And here we see that some of the hype was potentially a little bit overblown. And this is exactly what we were referring to when we were telling listeners that perhaps a lot of news outlets should pump their brakes regarding the technology as they push back the idea of this Amazon Go location as reported by the Wall Street Journal. So again, the store is in beta test, but apparently difficult so far for that in-store technology to track more than 20 concurrent orders. Now, keep that in mind. I'm going to read you a set of headlines from late 2016 after Amazon began to roll out a promotional push and a bunch of press releases regarding this, as well as that YouTube video. From Reuters, Amazon opens line-free grocery store in challenge to supermarkets. From Fox Business, Amazon opens line-free grocery store in challenge to brick and mortar. From the Wall Street Journal, Walmart and Kroger strive to counter Amazon's grocery challenge. From Ars Technica, Amazon to challenge Walmart with new brick and mortar grocery stores. And then, of course, you have a various number of news outlets, including Wired, just picking up the press release and kind of running it straight from Amazon. So you hear about all of these challenges to grocers. We should keep in mind that the store is still under 2,000 square feet. So it's not a challenge to Walmart. It's not a challenge of Kroger. And as people were writing these articles, I think it was kind of a piggyback concept of, well, Amazon's taking over, Amazon's killing brick and mortar retail, and now they're going into brick and mortar themselves, and they're just going to rule everything here. But the reality of it is, this is still an unproven, untested concept. And when you talk about a line-free store, it's interesting that it has trouble tracking more than 20 concurrent orders. So you wouldn't be able to have more than 20 people within the store at any one time, which creates lines not on the back end of the experience at the checkout, but rather on the front end, because only so many customers can go into the store at one period in time. There's a great article on Recode that points out that Amazon might have wanted to license the technology out to other retailers once it proves the concept. Rather than using it in their own stores, they can tap into some of the brick and mortar expertise of these other retailers. But again, if you're looking at a traditional convenience store or C store in 7-Eleven or in a Circle K or even in a Quick Trip in the southern United States and on into the Midwest, there's more than 20 concurrent orders in many of those stores at most periods throughout the course of the day. And certainly that is the case in places like Kroger and Walmart. So it looks like this technology is a little bit further off than we initially thought. And what's more, Leighton, is they've reported some online delivery issues as well.
Yeah, this is what was interesting, is that these were actually two different articles that you and I were reading. And then if you look back in 2015 and 2016, the entire industry, the entire grocery industry seemed wary of the online business that Amazon was promoting. And we're talking about the grocery delivery service, which they've had in several markets now. Bloomberg had a great article looking into some of the operational difficulties and inefficiencies of Amazon's grocery business dating back to 2014. There was a research paper by Varish Modi, who now works for Boston Consulting Group. He highlighted some very serious issues, Trent. He said that unutilized labor, the lack of freshness with produce, and a cookie-cutter mentality that stemmed to all levels of management was actually some of the major issues that they've been having overall with their grocery delivery business. These types of issues tend to be more commonplace where retailers are trying to provide an intentional disconnect with their customer. And by that, I mean Amazon Go, Amazon Fresh, all of these delivery services are intended to be as hands-off as humanly possible towards your end consumer. However, we have found time and time again within the grocery industry that people actually do want to be connected with their merchandise. We had talked about this a few months ago, or in produce, a lot of people love to go over the produce section, look at the products in regards to the ripeness, the aesthetic quality. We're talking about bruising on apples, those types of things. And then just the general freshness. They get a sense of what they're looking at by comparing different generations of vegetables and fruits. So I think overall, you're having that disconnect, which some people like. Some people like the convenience of just being able to have a one-click mechanism and get something 2 hours later at your doorstep. But here, Trent, We've had a lot of complaints about moldy strawberries that the companies had to return, and that's going to eat into the bottom line over time. So online grocery is failing, is what Kurt Jetta said, the chief executive at Tabs Analytics, a consumer research products firm. This was actually interesting in that 4.5% of people had frequent online grocery purchases in 2016. This just up very slightly from the 4.2% from 4 years ago. So using that data and citing that data, we can see that the grocery industry, the delivery service within the grocery industry, has not grown as much as analysts had said. This accounted for only $20 billion in online orders if you look at the basket overall in grocery sales in the United States. We're talking about an over $800 billion industry. And if you look at just the supermarkets, Trent, detracting Walmart supercenters, we're talking about a market opportunity of roughly $615 billion. So one might think, if you're looking from the outside in, if you're an Amazon or if you're another e-commerce retailer that think you can have a small part of this industry and still be profitable, it is a very large industry. And even if you want just a tiny piece of the pie, it's going to come at a very large expense because you're going to have to be a disruptor to those that are very long established in this industry.
I don't want to go so far as to say that online grocery is failing, as Kurt Jetta mentioned. I think it's just growing at a slower rate than what people expected, as Leighton mentioned. And you talk about just the slight variance in the increase in people regularly shopping for groceries online that Leighton mentioned. It's just a 0.3% increase when you look on a percentage point basis from where we were at 4 years ago. A good portion of that continues to be specialty grocery or other grocery items that are somewhat unique to the e-commerce space and not necessarily subscription services like those from Amazon or like those from Jet.com. So it is notable that there are some struggles with online grocery. Another thing that e-commerce grocers have to be aware of is certainly the presence and the increase in those last mile services with businesses like Shipt out there. And Leighton talked about moldy strawberries and also a generalized markup on products as Amazon's online grocery selection doesn't really compete on price. I think some of these last mile services, you look at Shipt as an example, it's used pretty widely by a number of different Kroger grocers throughout the southern part of the United States. What Shipt does to differentiate themselves from, say, an Amazon online program or any other produce delivery service is they actually have people that are capable of telling when fruit is ripe. They test people on that front, and they make sure you have some experience in grocery selection, whereas with a typical grocery delivery service just from an e-commerce platform, you're just basically getting strawberries sent out to you, or you're getting blackberries sent out to you, not necessarily the fruit on the shelf that's in the best condition. I think these last mile services are positioned perhaps in a better way to take a bigger chunk of the market share. But the funny thing is, the last mile services really do benefit the brick and mortar retailers too, because even though those services might take a small chunk out of the top line revenue of the brick and mortar retailers, of the traditional grocers, the reality is they're still using the grocers as part of the delivery mechanism, as part of the supply chain to get those products to customers. So I think that's kind of a different setup, but one that seems to be more comfortable for consumers as those last mile services continue to grow. Now, despite everything that we've talked about regarding e-commerce grocery sales, a study was released in January and produced by the Food Marketing Institute and Nielsen, which points out that grocery e-commerce is likely to garner significantly more market share in the next decade, from the 4.5% we noted in 2016 to 20% in 2025. This is based now on the most bullish prediction in the study. However, when we think back to 4 and 5 years ago, there were a number of studies that quoted our adoption of e-commerce grocery shopping much higher than where we're at now. So most of these studies do have to be taken with a grain of salt. Still, people out there tend to believe that e-commerce grocery sales will continue to expand during the course of the next decade. I think we would agree with that sentiment. The only question here is how much, and can they prove some sort of a cost benefit or a convenience benefit to consumers over those last mile services, which are starting to become more prevalent?
Yeah, despite the slowing of growth, it seems that Amazon is still going full speed ahead with its online initiatives. Last year, Amazon was reportedly changing up their leadership teams, Trent, to address some of the issues in their grocery delivery services. This around the August timeframe. So this still has not even been a full year yet. So we have yet to see a lot of drastic changes for the company. And some analysts have said that despite repositioning some of these management positions and maybe including some more personnel to address some of these complaints, they're going to want to maybe focus more on the brick and mortar concept, which is interesting because this is one half of this story that we just got done talking about, and that both brick and mortar and their grocery delivery service have come up against some headwinds. So it is interesting that they have some softness in these categories, but one thing is for sure, they don't have a lack of capital. So if Amazon puts their mind to something, you can be sure that they're going to at least try to attempt to make something better. We should mention that despite all of this, Trent, you had mentioned that the study says that the industry overall is very bullish on the future of grocery delivery. Well, Amazon as a company overall, the entire company selling those books, those electronic items, and their AWS platform, the company is up again as a stock to all-time highs today. Shares are up more than 2% on Wednesday, ending the day around $874 a share, representing a $421 billion market cap. And to put this in perspective, Walmart's market cap at the end of trading on Wednesday was around $221 billion, so nearly half of Amazon's. Shares are around $598 this time last year, so still very bullish on the company. And if you look through Jeff Bezos' remarks over the past year, he said that there is still no reason not to buy Amazon shares.
Well, I don't think he would give people a reason to stop buying Amazon shares, not with that price-to-earnings ratio that Amazon boasts, much greater than a company that is considered to be already fully ripe like a Walmart that you mentioned. Well, into specialty retail now, as GameStop announced last week that they will be consolidating some of their stores. This news comes alongside a very disappointing earnings release. They said they'll be closing between 2 to 3% of their current store base. As it stands, this could mean as many as 198 stores or as little as 130. But GameStop left one important detail out, this being whether or not the bulk of their stores would be in their larger U.S. market. Currently, the gaming retailer has over 6,600 stores globally with over 4,400 in the U.S. Now, their CEO, Paul Raines, said in a statement last Thursday that the video game category was weak, particularly in the back half of 2016. And this is something that when you look at GameStop, you have to keep in the back of your head, as they are a very volatile company. Much of their successes in terms of same-store sales metrics and in terms of top-line revenue can be attributed to popular games coming out or additional game consoles or systems coming out onto the market. So for that reason, oftentimes same-store sales and that particular metric can be a tricky one to look at for GameStop. Really what you're looking at is kind of a full-year overall metric, because that helps to work out some of the ebbs and flows. And the specialty retailer have seen a lot of ebbs and flows over the past year, but primarily they've been down as they've failed to bring in consistent traffic, and they're looking towards perhaps a couple of gaming systems on the horizon to maybe boost that traffic up. But the company and some analysts say the lack of new consoles could be hurting them.
Absolutely. And you see this really hurting the shares, Trent, with all of this negativity and that bad traffic that you had mentioned. Shares of the company are down 32% for the trailing year and down nearly 50% for the trailing 2 years. GameStop is a publicly traded company, so we're able to see a lot of their struggles in a public perspective. And Trent, when this story broke, you had some excellent insight into why this may be, and to blame the lack of new consoles is point on. This is what a lot of analysts had been saying after this news broke. And so based off of that, I did a little bit of digging. If you look at both the Microsoft Xbox and the current Sony PlayStation 4, they are older consoles. With the new console means a release of new games typically and new things overall to go with that. So you have a lot of upgrades with those games. And so overall, you have not seen that except for the Nintendo Switch and the newer iterations of both the Xbox One and the Sony PlayStation 4. But they've been dealing with these 3 to 4 year old consoles for the most part. The PS4 was released in North America in November of 2013 and the Xbox One right around that same time. And Trent, if you look at the future of gaming is going to be a little bit different. A lot more people play PC games. But in an interview with Engadget, Xbox head of games marketing, Aaron Greensburg, said that the Xbox Scorpio marks the beginning of the end for the traditional console life cycles for Microsoft. The Scorpio will be released sometime this year in October or November, and it will be backwards compatible. But they're looking at a whole new concept in terms of consoles, and they're not going to be having typical console generations anymore, Trent. And I think this is what's going to hurt GameStop for the future. It's a little bit under wraps as to what Project Scorpio means for the company. But what he said was they're going to have no more generations of consoles, and basically everything you have currently is going to continue going forward, and they're going to have it more as a family of devices. So you're going to be able to use VR systems with this Scorpio and then other things that have been making their way onto the market as product innovations. But there's also rumors that there's going to be an E3 launch of the PS5 this year, which could actually mean a continuation of the conventional console. However, again, some adaptation possibly with their VR system over there at Sony. E3 is the gaming development expo that occurs every summer. Last summer, it occurred around mid-July. Again, and I had mentioned this earlier, Nintendo Switch, which was released nationwide on March 3rd, could provide some much-needed assistance with GameStop, as there were 1.5 million units shipped on the second week of its formal release overall.
Now, one thing I'll be clear on is that I'm not very well in tune with the gaming industry as a whole. Obviously, we pay attention to new releases and new gaming consoles that come out to see exactly if or how they will be impacting some of these retailers like GameStop. So what I actually did was, during this last week, I knew we were going to be talking about GameStop, and I chased down the host of a gaming podcast or a gaming news podcast called Around the Digital Block. It's hosted by someone that goes by the stage name That One Andrew. Anyway, I chased down Andrew, asked him a little bit about the economic impact he believed the Nintendo Switch would have on the gaming industry and on the economics of the gaming industry. And what he told me was fairly interesting and was actually an angle I hadn't thought about before. He told me that obviously the Nintendo Switch is very popular. It created a massive rush towards stores like GameStop, those that were carrying it, and also e-commerce retailers that were selling it. But, he said, so far, many of the most popular games out there, and he noted Overcast as one such game, aren't actually making iterations of their game design for the Nintendo Switch. So while he thought that the gaming console in and of itself might boost sales for retailers like GameStop, he said that many of the games that GameStop relies on sales to boost sales, basically, aren't coming out for the Nintendo Switch. And this includes some of the most popular titles among gamers. So right now, there's kind of a dearth of names out there for Nintendo Switch. And he said, looking into the future, and I thought this was interesting, not many games have attached themselves to the Nintendo Switch, at least as of yet. He said there's always a possibility for games to be developed back to be compatible with the Switch, and then you might see some traffic towards the retailers like GameStop. So maybe Nintendo Switch will be a one-time boost, but it may not be a more permanent quarterly boost for GameStop, the likes of which that we've seen with other console releases. And honestly, looking at the analysis provided by Xbox head of games marketing Aaron Greensburg regarding Xbox Scorpio, you can see kind of where they're going with that. If you look at a lot of software, even nowadays, it's not a matter of upgrading and going to the store and buying a DVD. If you have, let's say, Adobe Creative Cloud, that's something that you pay a monthly fee for and it automatically updates, but you also skip the middleman. You don't have to go to the Best Buys of the world or the software companies of the world to go out and buy it. It automatically updates, automatically charges your bank account, and you basically cut out the middleman. And Greenberg seems to be suggesting something like that with Xbox Scorpio. So tying it all back, what does this mean for GameStop? Well, it means for GameStop that they have to find a way to diversify. And this is something they well know, as they've signed several partnerships with mobile carriers to sell phones and contracts. This helps to leverage their enormous store presence in the United States. We talked about how they have over 4,000 stores in the U.S., and they can do this without infringing much on their individual square footage. It doesn't take up much square footage, and they can make better use of the square footage they do have by kind of tracking some of the older used games, moving them off the sales floor, and moving these mobile carrier plans onto the sales floor. As of May 2016, the average GameStop location, about 1,800 square feet, about that size of the Amazon Go location that we talked about. For the average phone kiosk, you typically need just about 110 square feet. So this is a small ask for GameStop stores for something that might be beneficial in the long term to their top line revenue. They've also increased their sales of collectibles and memorabilia, which peaked around the Pokemon Go craze, but they've got to stay on top of future trends. And right now, after that Pokemon Go craze came out, there really hasn't been something to replace that. So again, GameStop is so reliant on trends right now. Things don't look so great outside of the console sales for the Nintendo Switch as far as driving long-term game sales. And without any kind of popular game or popular rehash of a game up on the horizon, you kind of worry about their collectibles and memorabilia sales as well.
Absolutely. And I think that was the one bright spot for me, at least if you look at a competitor in Vinted Stock, a company that we covered not too long ago. They've actually been seeing a lot of success selling their plush toys and other game-centric memorabilia. So I think this could be a potential for them as they look to try to diversify, as you had mentioned. As previously noted, shares of GameStop, ticker GME, have fallen precipitously over the past few years. As of Friday's closing, shares hit a four-year low. Currently, shares are hovering around $22 a share, a bit above that four-year low. However, a dismal 6.4 price-to-earnings ratio, representing a $2.31 billion market cap. We return with the second block of the Retail Focus. This with an earnings story in Restoration Hardware as they reported their fourth quarter earnings. Trent, this was a looking ahead story for you last week. They beat Wall Street estimates, but still coming through with some concerning numbers on a deeper look. They reported their fourth quarter earnings on Tuesday, March 28th, after the closing bell. If we look at the numbers here, revenue fell 9%, almost 10%, to $586.7 million for the fourth quarter, which is obviously not a positive trend. However, it did beat these analysts' expectations. Then net income fell by over 30% to $27.9 million from the last quarter, where they reported $41.2 million. And then on the earnings per share side, this represented 68 cents per share last year, also trending downward, but still beating analysts' expectations on the profit side of things. However, if you look at the GAAP numbers were 23 cents per share on an earnings per share basis. The difference being here is they were counting in the RH Modern cost as a new concept for the company. And really, right now, you see that this company is charging a lot of what is considered by most to be capital investments. So a lot can look at this and say, well, this is the natural progression of a company, so perhaps we should include this in the non-GAAP measure as well. But for the full year, revenues did increase just slightly. This was the bright spot for the company overall, Trent. I think that's possibly why the shares popped as they did. They increased 1.2% to $2.13 billion again for the full fiscal quarter. This was largely on the back of new store openings and their RH Modern concept, since they experienced double-digit same-store sales declines at the same time last year. As for those galleries, they closed five of them during the quarter and opened five of what they call next generation galleries, along with their acquisition of 15 Waterworks showrooms. But Trent, despite beating analyst expectations overall, it appears as though danger signs still exist for the company that is relatively new in the industry.
It's interesting because their stock really did pop after this earnings release. But you know, if you beat analysts' expectations and analysts absolutely expect you to tank and you only partially tank, that may not be a really good thing overall. And you see their share price now at some of the highest numbers it's been in over 12 months. But danger signs when you look at this company still exist that maybe the market isn't seeing. In a weird twist, when you start to delve into the numbers for Restoration Hardware, I don't know that we've seen this from any other retailer. For the full year, Restoration Hardware showed brick-and-mortar sales increases of 9%. There are a lot of retailers that will show brick-and-mortar sales increases. However, e-commerce and direct-to-consumer sales declined 7%. I can't remember a retailer that we've talked about on the show, Leighton, where we've talked about direct-to-consumer revenues actually declining. It seems like every retailer, e-commerce revenues have gone up by leaps and bounds, and brick-and-mortar revenues have been somewhat variable depending on the success of the concept. Now, because this is a full-year stat, this is due likely to some of their supply chain issues at the beginning of the year, but it seems to have legs in terms of how much it's impacting their top line revenues from online or direct to consumer approaches. Is I was under the impression that perhaps their quarter four online revenues would at least increase enough over the previous year to perhaps come close to breaking even for the year as a whole. They actually did worse than that. They saw net revenues from direct sales decline 15% after increasing by 8% the year before in the fourth quarter. So despite the fact that they said their supply chain issues they feel like are behind them, they're still seeing drastic declines in their catalog business and their e-commerce business. And looking ahead on the company, I worry that perhaps e-commerce may be stagnating for them, or maybe they ran too many customers off during the first two quarters of 2016 when wait times for certain pieces lasted 3 to 6 months. But you look at also their overarching concept, and I think this is a concern for the future as well. The tagline for their RS Modern concept is where less is more and minimal is magnified. And so you have this splintering of concept here, and it's kind of the same thing that Nordstrom has to answer for, but they've done a better job of towing the line, because if you go to the regular Restoration Hardware website, you have things like a long serving table for $14,000. And they've got all this luxury furniture, and yet they have one foot in this semi-off-price with the RH Modern. And then you have, of course, the RH Grey Card or the RH Membership Card that might save you 25% off purchases during the course of the year. So they're trying a number of different things. It's almost like they're just throwing darts at a dartboard to see what sticks. And we've seen this splintering of concept over the past 2 to 3 years as the company has begun to struggle from regular sales increases and fall off from that point. One of the other things I'm concerned with is it was quoted in their news release is that Gary Friedman, their CEO as well as their chairman, was quoted as saying they began the redesign of their supply chain network during fiscal year 2016, as he called it a year of transition. But he mentioned that they transitioned inventory into fewer facilities, and it enabled them to forego building a planned distribution center for 2017. He's alluding, of course, to their supply chain issues that dogged them throughout the first part of 2016. But I'm not completely sold that transferring inventory to fewer facilities, consolidating that network, and making sure that you're not building an extra distribution center seems to be helping anything on the supply chain front. And there still seems to be, as I peruse their website, some supply chain hiccups across the board. And overall, they might have a better idea of it certainly internally, but externally, given the numbers and the end numbers that we see from their website, and given the perusal of their website now, still seeing a few hiccups here and there, I'm not sure that the fewer facilities model has really enabled them to change anything. My final areas for concern for Restoration Hardware, their brick and mortar revenue was down 4% in the fourth quarter after growth of 15% in the prior year. Fourth quarter. Tough comps, but still they declined despite having more physical locations and upgrading several locations as they managed to close down several of their older, or what they called the legacy galleries, including in areas in Pittsburgh, Seattle, Tampa, and Kansas City, opening next generation design galleries in suburbs of many of those same markets, including Seattle, Pittsburgh, and the Kansas City metro area. They also opened a Waterworks San Francisco showroom. We should also mention that they excluded their Waterworks locations from that number in the fourth quarter, but they did manage to gain some Waterworks locations. They managed to stack on an additional 15 Waterworks showrooms acquired. Think restoration hardware for kitchens and bathrooms. It's that type of concept, almost like an upscale tile shop, which is having really good success with their overall concept. Still, they have what many would consider a lower price point than the Waterworks showrooms under Restoration Hardware. To sum things up, just because they beat analysts' really low expectations doesn't necessarily mean they're trending in the right direction. It just means that they beat expectations that were fairly already low for the company. And I think looking ahead, I tend to be a little bit more bearish on their projections for 2017 than they seem to be. And analysts seem to be pretty bullish on the company for this next fiscal year.
Analysts actually do forecast $1.94 a share on a full year basis for 2017 on the earnings per share side of things, and $2.33 billion in revenue. So they're actually forecasting an increase in both of these numbers for the company if you compare to these full year 2016 numbers that we just rattled off. Earnings for the company, they're projected to be $1.78 to $2.19 a share. The only spot there that I was a little worrisome about was the fact that that range is fairly large, Trent. So you're looking at a company that may not be that sure how they're going to operate or how they're going to execute in 2017, which may be a little worrisome for shareholders in the long run. But you see, this is going to be off a revenue of $2.3 to $2.4 billion, which is right in line with analyst forecasting. But right now, as it stands, shares are up an astonishing 15% on Wednesday. Currently around $43 a share, right where they were this time last year, Trent, as you had mentioned, kind of cratering a couple times throughout this last year. If you look, the stock hit around $25, $26 a share multiple times with the bad news hitting the media outlets, but a growth-centric price-to-earnings ratio of around 63 now as these shares go up, with a $1.85 billion market cap. And to sum it up from my perspective, I think this company really does have a ceiling, a very translucent ceiling, because you're seeing that a concept here is only going to be attractive for some people in certain demographics. You had mentioned a $14,000 side table, which would be around $11,000 if you do have that membership with them. But overall, you're seeing that a lot of their furniture is extremely expensive, not just the indoor furniture, but the outdoor as well. And you see this concept really not in a lot of other retailers. You're seeing that they are trying to be high-end with that off-price membership model. And it's going to be curious to see how they're able to transform themselves from a very, very volatile 2016.
I wanted to make one more note regarding their forecast for next year. Astute listeners might be asking the question, well, if they excluded Waterworks locations from their revenue numbers in fiscal year 2016, are they planning on including them in 2017? And might that impact analysts' forecast and their own forecast for top-line revenue? The answer to that is they're actually including Waterworks revenues beginning 1 month following the anniversary of the finish off of the sale, which happened midway through the second quarter of their fiscal year. So they'll get the benefit of about 2.5 quarters worth of additional top-line revenue from Waterworks. Whether that's enough to cause an increase of 10% on top-line revenue, I'm not completely sold, especially considering it reflects an increase in overall store count of right around 15 to 20%.
Well, with that, I get the pleasure of introducing our last story for this edition of the Retail Focus. True Value released their 2016 annual report this month. Somewhat surprisingly, results show an ability to compete with the much larger Home Depot and Lowe's, which has been killing it in the United States markets this year. True Value is a retailer co-op, meaning that they have different individuals owning different True Value locations, but they have similar processes, products, and corporate governance to direct general store maintenance. So basically, True Value is the parent of the individual retailers there. They are a similar model actually to that of Ace Hardware, which competes in the same exact space. True Value is the umbrella over several other banners as well, not just Destination True Value or True Value. They have Green Thumb, Grand Rental Station, Taylor Rental, and Party Central, which are all standalone franchises as well. True Value has branded products that it sources to individual stores through a number of regional distribution centers. They have about a dozen or so regional distribution centers. And this is actually where they're able to source these branded parts and products to these individual stores in their markets. But they have a corporate staff of over 3,000 employees to assist with this branding and then some advertising services, HR as well. And they are a co-op. So this means that they have what's called gross billings within their annual filing. And it's kind of hard to figure out what this figure meant, Trent, but we had to look it up. Gross billings are actually the total cost of a product without any deductions. So if you look at it from a general perspective, you have a contractor that might come in and buy a pallet of paint, but only needs one half of the pallet. That gross billing actually represents that entire pallet. What is deducted from that becomes the revenue for the company. So speaking of revenue, that was up 1.1% to $1.5 billion. The gross billings came in at $2.07 billion, which was also up around 2% from last year's numbers. Overall, you see that the company overall, Trent, has differentiated themselves, and they are doing a very good job at the individual store level to get those customers coming in and increasing traffic as time goes on.
When we look at comparable store sales for what they call Destination True Value or their True Value stores, their comparable store sales were up 3.7% for just that concept for the entirety of the fiscal year, which dovetails rather nicely with what you see throughout the rest of the home improvement sector, whether it's giants like Home Depot or Lowe's, like Leighton mentioned, Ace Hardware throw into that, or even specialty retailers like Sherwin-Williams. All of them saw mid-single-digit same-store sales increases during the entirety of the fiscal year, so things trending upward for home improvement retail. The company also experienced its sixth consecutive year, talking about True Value here, of increased annual sales and third year of sales from new stores, exceeding the lost sales from terminated stores. They actually closed relatively few stores. Now, across all banners, their total same-store sales increased 2.5%, but again, not all of those you would classify maybe in the retail sector. Some of them are rental franchises, as Leighton mentioned, Grand Rental Station and Taylor Rental, and Party Central is in a different category altogether. But one thing I wanted to touch on for our listeners that may be unfamiliar with True Value, other than knowing that they are a hardware store and a hardware co-op, they call it Destination True Value because Destination True Value was a store format rolled out in 2008 after being tested in 2006 and 2007. Now, not all True Values are technically Destination True Values, but enough of them have upgraded to this new store format such that that's what they call it in their earnings release. And again, they aren't publicly traded, so basically any information we get in our earnings release there is bonus information. Regarding the Destination True Value concept, I think it's very interesting because it's almost built for a co-op type store or even a franchisee type setup because they offer plug and play options. In fact, over 150 different what they call plug and play options for different layouts, square footage assignments, and to accommodate regionality. So their members, as they are called since they're in a co-op, can pick and choose from these different plug and play options to see what works best in their individual region and what works best in their square footage. Many of these stores have a square footage anywhere between 8 and 20,000 square feet, but they do vary widely based on location to location, as does the metro area. You know, some True Values are in very large metro areas, some True Values are in small metro areas. In fact, towns of fewer than 1,000 people even will sometimes have a True Value. And so to get people and members to upgrade to this Destination True Value format, around a decade ago, True Value offered a 5-year 50-50 low interest loan to be paid from the cash and note portion of the members' patronage dividend so that members could upgrade their options. And as a result, I think you're seeing bump in same store sales increases for the retailer because the stores in this Destination True Value layout makes it much more of a household goods retailer than just a simple neighborhood hardware store, especially in how the goods and products are displayed. Their net margin, getting back to this year's results, came in at $23.7 million, which is up over 24%, which is rather notable. They have 9 total main categories. Of them, the strongest were paint. Again, we talked about Sherwin-Williams and their success during the last year. Farm and Ranch, Auto and Pet, and Lawn and Garden. And of course, of those, Farm and Ranch and Lawn and Garden are very variable based on weather. So what we're getting from this is favorable weather patterns in 2016, at least for those categories. The retailer believes that they're differentiating themselves basically by having these value-added programs in stores to assist customers with certain projects. They also believe it seems like that by giving a high level of autonomy to the individual store managers or to the members, that the individual stores will be able to provide a more localized feel, very similar to Francesca's in a different sector that we discussed last week in the boutique industry, if you will, rather than a lot of big box stores, which don't showcase a ton of regionality. They might throw in a few local feels here and there, but generally speaking, you're going to see a different experience when you walk into a True Value because of this overall concept, because of this destination True Value concept where they have these plug and play options, than you're going to get inside your traditional big box retailer. And what I found interesting is that their strategic plans are tied to financial goals as well. They want to see continued double-digit net margin increases. This is a company, even though we consider them almost like a legacy retailer in the U.S., that is very much focused on growing out and very much focused on the future. And you see this in their investments during the last fiscal year.
Yeah, the company rolled out several strategic initiatives over the last 2 years, actually, and they were able to enact a lot of it over the past year. They said they recorded 101 remodeled stores and a record 68 completed ground-up stores, which were new stores entirely, representing almost a million square footage to add to the retail base, which is a lot when you're talking about a relatively small co-op inside the United States. They were also named number one retailer by Temkin Experience Ratings, an improved score in JD Power rankings as well for the follow-up rollout of their new customer service training for retailers. You had mentioned how the service aspect of True Value is one of their most important ways to differentiate. We're talking about the Lowe's and Home Depot's of the world, where you look at those workers sometimes not as experts, but just as people working for a larger corporation. And with True Value, this is how they really look to differentiate themselves and provide that one-up in customer service. They also had enhanced fulfillment options, including a retrofit and 3 distribution centers, enabling 2-day shipping for some customers in certain markets. Significant sales growth. Obviously, we have talked about that as a theme for them with those same-store sales increases. But they have an assortment program with average retail sales up 4.7%, where they were able to optimize in participating stores. And lastly, increased international sales of 14.5%. Much of our podcast is dedicated to domestic growth, but here you have True Value, a successful co-op in the United States looking for brand extension outside of the U.S.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we reach the final segment on the Retail Focus podcast, where each Leighton and I look ahead to a story that we are seeking out in the next week or next month. And Leighton, we'll begin with you.
So this story actually has to do with something we had talked about very, very briefly within this podcast, and that is with Kroger, as they're launching a new website called www.krogerstories.com. It's to share their corporate values with the stakeholders at the company, but they're wanting employees to really engage with the general public to give their personal stories about how they've either persevered or grown up with the company. And so I think this really ties in nicely to what we've been talking about in terms of really having a down-to-earth feel as a corporation. Kroger is this massive company with over 3,000 different grocery stores in the United States and acquiring more and more every year, it seems. And so with this, they want to be able to draw attention to their associates and really let them know that they're an important part of the company. And I'm very curious to see how this plays out. A few years ago, Walmart actually released something a little bit similar to MySpace, if our listeners actually remember that social media platform, where people could get on there and actually talk one-on-one with other associates within the company and then share their stories as well. So I think this is sort of an extension of that, but I am curious to see how it pans out and if the adoption numbers are as high as Kroger wants them to be long-term.
Well, my looking ahead story is towards a retailer we don't talk about a whole lot because they are privately held in PetSmart. Coming up in a couple of weeks, PetSmart on Monday, April 10th, actually, will be releasing its fourth quarter and fiscal year 2016 results. We don't typically hear a lot about the pet products industry simply because so many of the brands there and so many of the retailers in that sector are privately held. But usually, especially from the year-end results, some information leaks out about these retailers like PetSmart and Petco. And so I'm anxious to see where exactly the pet retail industry is headed over the last few years, especially for a business like PetSmart that has seen steady expansion in the last decade. Well, that'll do it for us on the Retail Focus Podcast for Leighton. I'm Trent. Check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast, in between podcasts for all the up-to-date retail information. You can drop us a line as well, retailpodcast@gmail.com. Be sure and subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcast listening service, including on Android, Podcast Addict, or Podcast Republic. Again, we'll be back 1 week from now with more news from the world of retail.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.